Chapter 8. Repairing the Damage. The little Burmese pavilion was only big enough to hold one person. It stood not far from the guest cottage, on the angle formed by the two banks that marked the boundary in that corner of the property. Burma Raja had built it some years previously, and already much of the gilding had worn off the little pinnacled roof. What was left of it still gleamed in the sunlight, and the tiny wind bells that hung from the eaves still tinkled merrily or mournfully in the breeze. Sometimes I sat there in the evening, if the weather was not too cold, watching the sun as it sank behind the dark blue Darjeeling Hills. It was very peaceful on that side of the town, and as one more day ended, I was gladder than ever to be staying there. By placing his guest cottage at my disposal, Burma Raja had certainly rescued me from a dilemma, at least for the time being. There was no longer any question of the freedom of the open road or the shelter of a kindly tree being the only alternative I had to the hate-ridden atmosphere of the Dharmodya Vihara. Thanks to the generosity of a warm-hearted old man who had troubles of his own to bear, I was now provided with a pleasant retreat where I could study and meditate, where I could get on with my literary work, and where I could receive Sachin and the other students whenever they came to see me. But though Burma Raja's dramatic intervention had solved the most pressing of my problems, it was far from having solved them all. There were new premises to be found for the YMBA, and funds to be raised to cover the extra expense that this would involve. At all costs, the damage Aniruddha had done to our activities must be repaired as quickly as possible. Banshee's Godown was a large wooden warehouse with a corrugated iron roof that stood a short distance below the main road, on the way down to the bungalows of my two Hindu Nirwar sympathisers. It was called Banshee's Godown after its owner, Banshilal Agarwala, a Mawari merchant well known in the town for his tight-fistedness. Since trade between India and Tibet was practically at a standstill, the place was more or less empty, and with Gopal Babu's help, I was able to rent 6 small rooms on the ground floor for 100 rupees a month. Our members were overjoyed. Once again, the beautiful iridescent ball that for the last few weeks had seemed in danger of hovering permanently above our heads, or even of floating away altogether, could be invited to descend and take fresh mundane embodiment. Once again, the YMBA had a place for its activities, and one that was, moreover, even nearer to the centre of town than the Vihara. It did not take us long to adapt the new premises to our requirements. 2 of the rooms were departitioned so as to make a large room for ping-pong. We salvaged our old ping-pong table from the former recreation hut. 1 room became a reading room, 1 for the YMBA office, while the 2 remaining rooms were set aside for the evening tutorial classes. Within a matter of days, all the old faces had reappeared and our activities were flourishing vigorously. Indeed, they were flourishing more vigorously than ever, for the new premises in Banshee's Godown were ours in the sense that the Dharmodya Vihara had never been. Nonetheless, the change was not without its drawbacks. The immediate surroundings of the warehouse were not nearly so attractive as those of the Vihara. Instead of lawns and flower beds, there were mounds of rubbish and the heavily rusted chassis of old cars. Moreover, although they were only a few hundred yards from the centre of the town, the new premises were more than 2 miles from Panorama. For me, this meant that whenever I wanted to take part in YMBA activities, I had a long walk each way, a walk along what was at night a dark and deserted road. There was also the question of raising funds to meet the extra expense that we were now incurring in the way of rent, as well as the continued expense of running our usual program of activities. Membership subscriptions did not even cover the cost of the ping-pong balls. Where was all the money to come from? For help in solving this problem, I turned to Madan Kumar Babu and Gopal Babu, as I often did at that time. Raising funds in Kalimpong was no easy matter, they warned me, however deserving the cause for which they were being raised might be. All sorts of organisations were going round fundraising all the time, and the public had naturally grown tired of being perpetually taxed in this way. Besides, Kalimpong was a trading centre. It was dependent for its prosperity on the wool trade with Tibet. Now that very little wool was coming through from Lhasa, there was very little money in circulating in the town. If I had come to Kalimpong a few years earlier... Eventually a plan of action was decided upon. Madan Kumar Babu would go out collecting donations with me every morning after breakfast for the next 2 or 3 weeks. Starting with the more well-to-do members of the community and confining ourselves to the bazaar area, we would try to see at least 4 or 5 people each day. If one substantial donation was forthcoming, others would follow. That was the way things were done in Kalimpong. In all probability, 2 or 3 weeks would be sufficient for us to raise several thousand rupees. We might even be able to collect enough money to build or buy a permanent headquarters for the YMBA. A day or two later, we started putting our plan into execution. At least we tried to start putting it into execution. When I turned up at Madan Kumar Babu's bungalow at 8 o'clock in the morning, as we had arranged, it was only to find that several clients had already come to see him on urgent business. By the time he had finished with them, it was too late for us to do anything, since at 10 o'clock he had to be in court, and he had not even had his breakfast. Much the same thing happened the next day and the next. Despite the earliness of the hour, there were always people waiting to see Madan Kumar Babu. If it was not clients, it was witnesses, and if it was not witnesses, it was other lawyers, and their business was always urgent. Clearly, there were disadvantages as well as advantages attached to being a successful lawyer with the largest practice in Kalimpong. While I waited for Madan Kumar Babu to finish, I studied the faces of his visitors. Almost without exception, they were of a particularly villainous and evil cast. Perhaps there really was a criminal type, as Lombroso contended in a book I had read many years before, except that here the criminals tended to be traders, commission agents, and big landowners. So villainous-looking were the faces of some of Madan Kumar Babu's visitors, indeed, that I was not surprised that he seemed relieved when he was rid of them at last. I would not have been surprised if he had gone and washed his hands after talking to them, or taken a bath. Compared with giving them consultations, going round the bazaar collecting donations for the YMBA seemed a very innocent occupation. It was not until I had turned up at Madan Kumar Babu's bungalow for the 3rd or 4th time, however, that he succeeded in extricating himself from the clutches of his clients and we could actually make a start. Even so, despite the abandonment of an important consultation, he had less than an hour at our disposal. In that time, we saw 3 or 4 high street traders, all Marwaris, and succeeded in raising a couple of hundred rupees. It was not a very propitious beginning, and I began to wonder if there was not something wrong with our plan of action. There certainly was something wrong with it. During the next 2 or 3 weeks, Madan Kumar Babu was able to go out collecting with me only 3 or 4 times, with the result that we saw only 10 or 12 people, and raised in all no more than 400 or 500 rupees. This was extremely disappointing. It was all the more disappointing because, as I had soon realised, it was not Madan Kumar Babu's intention that we should approach all the more well-to-do members of the community, but only those who were his clients and with whom he had a certain amount of influence. Yet even with this more selective approach, we had not done as well as expected. While it was true that there was very little money circulating in the town, the main reason for our failure, for failure it undoubtedly was, lay in the fact that, much as he might want to help us, Madan Kumar Babu was in reality far too busy to give to the work of collecting donations the time and thought it required. After we had raised 400 or 500 rupees, therefore, I stopped turning up at his bungalow in the morning and our plan of action was, by tacit agreement, shelved. Though the problem of raising funds with which to meet the expense of running the YMBA had not been solved, or solved only to a very limited extent, I was not sorry that I no longer had to go out collecting donations. The experience of approaching people who, for the most part, had no desire to give, and who only yielded to pressure of one kind or another, was not one that I found particularly pleasant. Indeed, during the 3 or 4 times I had gone out with Madan Kumar Babu, as well as on the 1 or 2 occasions I had gone out with Gopal Babu, or on my own, it had become more and more distasteful to me. Not that I had any regrets. In less than 3 weeks, we had raised enough money to keep the YMBA going for 3 or 4 months, excluding the cost of publishing Stepping Stones. Besides, I had learnt something about the way things were done in Kalimpong, and had come into contact with several people I might not otherwise have met. I had also been left with some very vivid personal impressions. The most vivid were those relating to our most reluctant donor, our most generous donor, and our most procrastinating donor. Our most reluctant donor happened to be our first, Madan Kumar Babu, having extricated himself from the clutches of his clients. It had taken us no more than 5 minutes to reach the high street. Our first call was at a shop of the traditional open-fronted Indian type, situated on the right-hand side of the road, only a few doors down from the Himalayan store. Here, on an enormous expanse of grubby white mattress, the mouthpiece of a hubble bubble between his aged gums, reclined the grossly fat figure of Banshilal. On top of the spherical body, there rested, necklace and completely bald, a spherical head. In the middle of the spherical head, there was a small spherical nose. And on either side of the spherical nose, there were 2 button eyes. In his grubby white shirt and dhoti, he looked for all the world like an enormous baby. There was nothing baby-like, however, about his expression, which was one of unfathomable shrewdness, meanness and greed. Many were the stories that were told in Kalimpong about Banshilal. He had made his fortune during the war, as so many people had done. There had been a shortage of washers. Banshilal had quietly accumulated several thousand rupees worth of the old copper Lal Paisa, or red farthings, which were, of course, perforated, had sandpapered them down a bit, and then sold them to the American army at more than 4 times their face value. But Madan Kumar Babu had no time for personal reminiscences that morning. "Bhikshuji has come for a donation," he announced crisply as he seated himself on the edge of the mattress. Balshilal's fat frame quivered like a jelly with the shock. "No, no," he protested hoarsely, removing the mouthpiece of the hubble bubble. That was quite out of the question. He could not possibly give any donation, not so much as a rupee. Times were bad. Business was very slack. He was barely able to feed himself and his dependents. But in the grip of his own lawyer, as Madan Kumar Babu was, who knew most of his secrets and who had a good idea how much he was worth, the dissembling old man was quite helpless. "Give him a receipt for 100 rupees," said Madan Kumar Babu coolly. "You can take it out of the rent." Banshilal threw up his hands in horror at this, and his button eyes rolled wildly in his head as though looking for some means of escape. But Madan Kumar Babu had risen to his feet and was already on his way to the next shop. After a moment's hesitation, I wrote out the receipt, deposited it on the mattress, and followed after him, leaving our reluctant donor sitting there with an expression of mingled indignation and reproach on his flabby countenance. Our most generous donor was Raja S.T. Dorji, the Bhutan agent in Kalimpong, and I went to see him not with Madan Kumar Babu, but with Gopal Babu. He lived at 12th Mile, in a large house with a red-tiled roof and cream-coloured rough-cast walls that seemed to belong to the home counties rather than to the foothills of the eastern Himalayas. Above the front gate was an enormous Dorje, or thunderbolt scepter, more than 6 feet in length, which somehow gave the place a sinister and threatening look. I had been to Bhutan House, as it was called, once or twice before, and had met Raja Dorje's wife, Rani Chuni Dorje, a small, stony-faced woman of about 50, who was the sister of the Maharaja of Sikkim, and therefore aunt of the fascinating Princess Pema Tsedjian. Either because she had heard what Swale had supposedly told Joe about a wealthy local Buddhist, namely herself, promising to give the YMBA 20,000 rupees, or, what was more likely, because she was naturally of a frigid and unexpansive disposition, she did not give me a particularly friendly reception. However, she thawed sufficiently to show me her magnificent chapel, which I had wanted to see ever since I first saw a photograph of it in Marco Palace's Peaks and Lamas. Judging by the amount of gold and silver it contained, the Dorje family was immensely wealthy. But though there was a silver butter lamp burning before the principal showcase, the atmosphere of the chapel was cold and sterile, like that of a drawing room that is used only on formal occasions. Some time later, Rani Chuni, with her eldest daughter, Tashi Dorje, attended our Dhamma Chakra Day celebrations. Since then, I had not seen her, and she had taken no further interest in our activities. When I turned up at Bhutan House with Gopal Babu, I was fortunate enough to meet Raja Dorje himself, as well as Rani Dorje and the rest of the family, and received a much friendlier reception than I had done before. Topgay Raja, as he was generally called, was a man of about 55 or 60, and, like his wife and other members of the family, wore traditional dress. In his case, it consisted of a simple Bhutanese knee-length gown, dark blue in colour, and sufficiently full in the bosom to serve as both pocket and shoulder bag. When Gopal Babu spoke about the YMBA's need for funds, he listened in a grave and kindly fashion, and from time to time nodded sympathetically. I noticed that, although he was of noble and dignified appearance, he entirely lacked his wife's more aristocratic graces. Despite his present apparent wealth, he was in fact of comparatively humble origin, his grandfather having been a sais. When Gopal Babu had finished speaking, Raja Dorje turned and said something to one of his sons, whereupon the young man at once left the room, returning a few minutes later with 201 rupees. This time I did not have any qualms about writing out the receipt. It was not exactly a princely donation, but there was little doubt that had we met Rani Dorje rather than her more open-handed spouse, the YMBA would not have received anything. Our most procrastinating donor did not live in Kalimpong at all, and I went to see him on my own. Shantabir Lama was a successful government contractor who lived in Siliguri, where he had built himself a big new house on the flat, marshy land, not far from the new but as yet unopened railway station. I had met him in Kalimpong, perhaps through Danmang Mokton, and he had invited me to spend a few days with him and his family whenever I wished to do so. Thinking that now was the time to take advantage of his invitation, as well as to approach him for a donation, I decided to pay a short visit to the hot, dusty, insanitary little town that was Siliguri. Shantabir Lama was a stout, energetic man in his early 40s with two wives, one old and one young, and a correspondingly large number of children of different ages. He could hardly have entertained me more hospitably, but it soon became evident that parting with cash was another matter. Much as I tried to bring him to the point of actually making a donation, he kept evading the issue by pressing me to stay another day. In the end, I had to fix the day of my departure regardless, but fortunately, just before I left, he gave me 25 rupees. While I was still busy raising funds for the YMBA, Joe, having finished winding up his affairs in Lucknow, returned to the fantastic sights and exotic inhabitants of his now beloved Kalimpong. He already knew what had happened at the Dharmodia Vihara, as I had written and told him about Aniruddha's closure of the recreation hut and his determination to have me out. But he had returned nonetheless, and with Burma Raja's permission, I gave him a room in the guest cottage. Here he would stay until such time as he could find somewhere suitable for himself and Dil Bahadur, the young Nepalese artist, to live and work. Now that I had Joe staying with me, the guest cottage was not so quiet or so peaceful as before. Burma Raja did not come down so often either, since, for one reason or another, he had never taken to Joe in the same way that he had taken to Swale, and often shook his head over him as if unable to make him out. Still, though he could be very prickly at times, Joe was on the whole lively and stimulating company, and I was not sorry to have him staying with me for a while. Indeed, his presence enabled me to set up some kind of establishment. Since my arrival at the guest cottage, Burma Raja and the princess had been sending lunch down to me each day, besides inviting me up to Panorama from time to time for a ceremonial food offering. Knowing how short of money they were, and not wanting to take advantage of their generosity more than was absolutely necessary, I ate out whenever I could, that is to say, whenever anybody invited me. Now that Joe was staying at the guest cottage, and there were two of us to share the expense, I decided that the time had come for me to take on a cook-bearer, and Rudramani found a Pradhan boy he thought would be suitable for the post. Gopal, as the boy was called, thus became the first of a whole succession of cook-bearers who were to serve me during the coming years. Plump and fair-skinned, he had a fixed, vacuous smile on his face, and he laughed softly to himself every few minutes. Though a reasonably good cook, he was painfully slow, and lunch was very often late, especially when he had been to market. However, we did not expect wonders for 20 rupees a month all found, and put up with him as best we could. Besides enabling me to set up some kind of establishment, Joe's presence at the guest cottage also made it necessary for me to come to a decision about a more serious matter. There was still disharmony within the YMBA. Though more than 6 months had passed since Joe had been invited up to Kalimpong as a full-time worker, he and Swale were as far from getting on well together as they had ever been. This was certainly not because they had tried and failed. To do the two men justice, they had not even tried. By the time of Joe's departure for Lucknow, it was therefore obvious that there was room in the YMBA for only one of my two helpers, and that if Joe did return to Kalimpong, I would have to choose between them. It was not even that they simply disagreed between themselves. Each tried to turn me against the other, and resented the fact that I could not be turned. To each of them, the fact that I could not see how evil and despicable the other was simply showed my own gullibility, my lack of maturity, and my need for more experienced guidance. Swale was unable to understand why I could not see that Joe was an upstart, a social climber, and an outsider. Why he had not even belonged to a decent regiment. He had been commissioned at all only because it was wartime and there was a shortage of officers. His substantive rank was probably only that of captain, anyway. And even if he had managed to become an officer, technically speaking, he was certainly not a gentleman and never would be one. Joe, for his part, was unable to understand why I could not see that Swale was a con man, a poseur, and a snob. Was he not abusing the hospitality of the Jyoti brothers in the most shameless manner? Did he not always refer to his hostess, their mother, as that old bitch, and openly boast of smuggling beef into the house, despite her religious objections? The fact of the matter was that there was some truth in what each man said about the other, but it was not the whole truth. I could see Joe's weaknesses as well as Swale, and Swale's no less clearly than Joe. But I could also see in both my helpers the positive qualities that the other could not see. This did not, of course, make it any easier for me to choose between them, now that Joe was back in Kalimpong and the time for a decision had come. If it had been at all possible, I would have liked to have kept both my pig-headed helpers, despite the trouble they gave me. But I could not ignore the fact that the disharmony within the YMBA had begun to spread from the higher to the lower levels of the organisation and was causing a certain amount of disquiet. Our members simply could not understand how it was that two Englishmen, both ex-army officers, both Buddhists, both working for the YMBA, and both on friendly terms with me, should be unable to get on well with each other, should, in fact, be on terms of more or less open hostility. In the end, I decided that Swale would have to be the one to go. Though I found him easier to get on with than Joe, he had been taking less and less interest in YMBA activities and hardly ever put in an appearance at Banchilal's go-down. Joe, on the other hand, despite his tendency to prickliness, had taken classes and helped with office work right up to the time of his departure for Lucknow. At the guest cottage, he was again doing my typing for me. There were also considerations of a more general nature to be taken into account. I had noticed that Joe was much more generous than Swale, and often made donations to the YMBA, whereas Swale had never given so much as a rupee. Somewhere among the thorny tangles of Joe's nature, there bloomed a redder rose of devotion to the three jewels than anything Swale could show. What weighed with me most, perhaps, was the fact that although the icy revulsion Joe had come to feel for Swale was no less strong than the cold antipathy Swale had come to feel for him, it was Swale who had been the original aggressor. Swale, therefore, would have to be the one to go. Fundraising and disharmony within the YMBA were not the only things with which I had to concern myself during the first 2 months of the new year. Fortunately, there were more peaceful things to think about, things more in keeping with the atmosphere of the place in which I was now staying. The second, still more iridescent ball that had descended when Stepping Stones came into existence had been in no danger of floating away, and had not needed, therefore, to take fresh embodiment like the first. Through all vicissitudes, a little monthly magazine of Himalayan religion, culture and education continued to be edited, printed and distributed. Neither in the editorial articles nor in the notes and news section was there the slightest reference either to the shutting down of the recreation hut or to the unpleasant way in which I had been squeezed out of the Dharmodia Vihara. So far as Stepping Stones was concerned, Aniruddha did not exist. The editorial articles continued to strike their unambiguously spiritual note with such topics as the awakening of the heart and rights and duties, while the news and notes section confined itself to reporting such matters as my recent visit to the plains and the activities of our Ajmer branch, as well as announcing the forthcoming arrival in Kalimpong of the sacred relics of the Arahants, Sariputra and Modgayana, the two chief disciples of the Buddha. The only item that could possibly be understood as referring to recent events at the Dharmodia Vihara was an extract from the Sutra of 42 sections, entitled On Returning Good for Evil, which I included in the January issue. As refracted through the medium of stepping stones, our second, still more beautiful iridescent ball was indeed incorporating brighter hues and more delicate tints than ever, thus creating a still richer and more harmonious effect. Both Lama Govinda and Dr. Gunter were now among our regular contributors, the brilliant hues of the one and the subtle purples of the other, forming a valuable addition to our total range. Within the first 3 months of the year, Lama Govinda contributed a poem entitled The Temple of Shunyata, which appeared in the January issue, and the first instalment of a 10-part article on the significance of Om and the foundations of mantric law, which appeared in the issue for March. In an introductory note to the poem, which had originated in a dream, I wrote, quote, "The symbolical language of poetry is often able to convey the intuitions of the spirit more vividly and clearly than the conceptual language of philosophy." Unquote. Some years later, the article on the significance of Om and the foundations of mantric law reappeared in slightly enlarged form as part one of Lama Govinda's book Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. Within the same 3 months, Dr. Gunter contributed an article on Ahankara and Selflessness, which appeared in two instalments in the February and March issues. Beginning with the issue for January, he also contributed to our Lotuses of the Mahayana section, a series of excerpts that he had selected and translated from the Gandavyuha Sutra, the principal text of the Avatantika school of Buddhism, which arose in China during the second half of the 6th century CE, and of the Kigon sect of Japan. As he explained in his introduction, the text describes the ideal of a bodhisattva. Quote, "The youth Susanna travels all over the India on the advice of the bodhisattva Manjushri in order to achieve the highest knowledge of enlightenment. He goes to all kinds of men, women and deities. Finally, by the help of the bodhisattva Samantabhadra, the highest knowledge is revealed to him, which is essentially the vision and experience of the interpenetration of each and every thing. In the course of his travels, he has sent from one teacher to another, because everyone, with the exception of Bodhisattva Samantabhadra, has only a limited knowledge." End of quote. In the course of the last few years, I too had travelled all over India. And like Susanna, I had met all kinds of men, women, and very nearly deities. Unlike Susanna's teachers, most of the people I encountered did not have even a limited knowledge of enlightenment. Nonetheless, though they were unable to teach me, I had learned from them. Sometimes the process was a painful one. In Kalimpong too, I had been meeting people and learning from them. No doubt the process would continue. End of chapter 8.